the official Saudi Al Arabiya channel, the Zionist Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu appeared speaking about the upcoming normalization between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Zionist entity. There's no embarrassment anymore in the appearance of Zionist personalities on Saudi channels, despite the series of lies that those in power inside Saudi Arabia stressing that there is no legalizing relations with the occupation so far. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. Thank you for being with us. Dr. Amal, now, Netanyahu spoke with Al Arabiya. That was not a surprise for me, at least. But in the interview, which was posted on its English language website, he said, and I quote, "A new peace initiative aimed at establishing a wonderful, historic peace with Saudi Arabia." Why is Saudi Arabia doing this move right now? And I mean, having him on the national TV if they don't want to normalize?
Well, I think that Saudi Arabia is not in a rush to do such a move, such a huge move. Especially if we take into considerations the global arena and the developments, especially the last OPEC Plus meetings and the differences that start to float between Saudi Arabia and the USA. So I think the Saudis are, you know, just trying to give, but not wholly. Because they know that there is a lot in stake if they do go in full normalizations with the Israelis. If they can do behind the scenes relationships and, you know, Israeli airplanes flying over Saudi Arabia, this is something that is not going to harm them much, although they lost, in front of the, at least, the Arab nationals and the axis of resistance. But on the other side, going fully normalization with the Israelis is a little bit risky for them. It's like, suiciding, because they will lose a lot. But if they can manage this relations away from fully normalizations, I think they will go for it. Actually, on last July, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia said that there is no normalizations with Israel, I quote, until two-state solution with the Palestinians. And this was like a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And this should be based on UN resolutions and withdrawal from other countries as well. I don't think that the Saudis are ready to make this lead.
Which is why, if we go to the interview, we see that Netanyahu is stressing that peace with Saudi Arabia, and I quote, will change the region in unimaginable ways. In what ways does it mean? I mean, the Abraham Accord with the UAE and Bahrain have changed nothing so far. And the proof, especially about the Arab sentiment during the World Cup that we saw in Qatar 2022, was against such normalization and in support of Palestine. So what does Netanyahu exactly mean by saying it will change the region?
We all know that Netanyahu is good in PR. He tries to impress the coalition. He's trying to impress the people inside the colonial apartheid regime in Palestine. But he cannot go ahead with this step before the Saudis before the Saudis give him this ticket to go ahead. They know the complications, and they are fully aware that this PR show that he makes in front of the TV, and I'm sure maybe he pressed a lot to make this interview with Al Arabiya and other Arab networks. I don't think that it's going to happen, and I don't think even with the problems that Netanyahu is facing forming this government, even with the ultra-nationalist, ultra-zealous parties in this coalition, I don't think that he is capable of even making this government. He has 2 days left on the 21st. If he doesn't succeed, he will not be able to make this government happen. So I don't think that it goes beyond, it will go beyond this PR show that he's trying to make.
I hear you, what you're saying. It is basically a PR campaign by Netanyahu to boost the polls on the inside of the occupied territories. But earlier last week, we did hear Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu revealing that he recently visited Arab countries that do not maintain relations with the Zionist Israeli entity. Everyone was suspicious that it might have been the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, but not a word was uttered against it or with it. What will the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia be risking in specific at this moment in time if they go along with whatever Netanyahu is pushing them towards, especially with this kind of normalization? What is the riskiest move that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia can make at this current moment in history?
We know that Saudi Arabia is trying to lead the Arab and somehow the Muslim world. So if they do this such step, it's going to hinder and it's going to really endanger their relations together with the Arab world and with the rest of the Muslim world. I do think that with the differences and the quarrels that they started to have after the OPEC Plus and even before with the Biden administration. And before that, we should remind people about the amount of insult and humiliation that Mohammed bin Salman had with the previous administration. So all this is not being silenced. One of the reporters, Israeli reporters actually, quoted bin Salman reminding Biden of Shirin Abu Akleh murder. Mm-hmm. When Biden was bickering at him about Khashoggi, he immediately pointed out the brutal killing of Shirin Abu Akleh. So the amount of differences and the amount of quarrels, even though we know that the Americans are not letting Saudi Arabia go to the east with the Russians and the Chinese. Now they feel like they have to balance their relations on the international arena. Inside the occupied territories, inside historic Palestine, the confrontations and the amount of aggression that the Israelis are enforcing against the Palestinians has also its weight, whether this move is going to bring peace and stability, as Netanyahu is saying, or it would accelerate the confrontations and elevate even the armed struggle in the West Bank.
Definitely, we have to wait and see then what will be the reply or response of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to such a push from Netanyahu. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for joining us from the West Bank to talk about this issue. I wish you the best. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how might Mohammed bin Salman reciprocate to the calling of Netanyahu. Will he approve or not? Next.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
After the recent electoral victory of Zionist Israeli Prime Minister-elect Benjamin Netanyahu, along with other right-wing Israeli politicians, his first foreign policy move was towards the conservative Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which houses Mecca, the holiest place for Muslims. Netanyahu's first time on an Arab TV channel was used and abused to push the kingdom into accepting what Netanyahu deemed a quantum leap for peace. Will Mohammed bin Salman take that leap and join the Abraham Accord without securing any gains for the Palestinians? More in this following report.
With a tense atmosphere inside the Israeli entity as the formation of the Zionist government approaches and security in the Palestinian areas continue to decline, Zionist Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu will need to bring forth a real achievement to ensure his new government withstands these circumstances. As countries in West Asia move to reposition themselves to face new perceived threats, considering the ongoing war in Ukraine, a major new deal, and one previously considered implausible, appears to be emerging as per Netanyahu himself during his first appearance on an Arab TV channel, the Saudi Al Arabiya. Netanyahu openly spoke during the interview that he can strike an unprecedented peace deal with the conservative Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which houses Mecca, the holiest place for Muslims, and a country that still has its school books referring to the Zionist occupation as the Zionist enemy. When one approaches the issue to analyze the facts, one can see that it is actually Netanyahu who desperately needs this type of deal with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and hence used his appearance on Al Arabiya to drag the kingdom into a deal that would ease the pressure of Netanyahu's already unborn government, which this time includes Zionist hardliners who have never made it to power yet. This fact has already made way for Netanyahu's opposers to voice their genuine fear of how the arrival of hardliners will only escalate the confrontation with the Palestinian resistance. It is true that warming relations with the Israeli entity have also been a recognized approach for Arab regimes whenever they face internal challenges, with a view to drumming up American and Western support against local opposition by appearing moderate, open, and tolerant. Three words now highly valued by Arab regimes facing survival issues. Netanyahu had already delivered a precious historic deal in August and September 2020 with the so-called Abraham Accords. It began with decisions taken by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain to enter into peace agreements with Israel. Sudan and Morocco followed soon thereafter. But what exactly did any of the signatories achieve since then? What did Israel really benefit from when the most important factor being the popular support was nowhere to be found, as evident by the FIFA World Cup that took place in Qatar, showcasing the Arabian public's support of the Palestinian cause and their disapproval of the Abraham Accord or anything that resembles it? Many analysts believe that Bahrain's deal with Israel could have only come about with a green light from Saudi Arabia, considering the close relationship between Manama and Riyadh. Many observers also believe that more steps will be taken to ease normalization between the Zionists and the Saudis following Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia, but rather what came was a massive dispute between Biden and Mohammed bin Salman following OPEC Plus's decision to reduce oil production. Put simply, Saudi Arabia does not have to fully enter the Abraham Accords to be a part of the Arab world's trend towards normalization, despite the ongoing deals of the Red Sea islands of Tehran and Sanafir and lifting restrictions on Israeli airlines using its airspace and featuring Netanyahu on Al Arabiya channel. But whether Netanyahu will be satisfied with just that remains to be seen.
Now, now to discuss this issue with us right here from Beirut is Ali Murad, journalist at Al Akhbar News Daily and political commentator and researcher. Thank you very much, Ali, for being with us. Now, Saudi Arabia has already lifted restrictions on Israeli airlines to use Saudi airspace, and Tel Aviv has also approved the transfer of the Red Sea islands of Tirad and Sanafir from Egypt to Saudi Arabia. I don't know why they had to approve, but that's how it's done. And now Saudis watched Netanyahu on their national Al Arabiya channel. Isn't all that already normalization?
No doubt that when such a Saudi broadcaster interviews a war criminal like Netanyahu, is enough evidence for the presence of a normalization between both entities, which has been there already for many years now and possibly many decades. There is nothing new here. What is new, actually, is the regime inside Saudi Arabia decided to patch up the level of indicators that prove the existence of a previous relationship. And it proves the existence of ambition and willingness to move forward in the process of normalization and its announcement. Of course, the Zionist side is the most expressive of the existence of this relationship, and the announcement of the steps that, from the Zionist perspective, are considered advanced within the framework of the Declaration of Normalization. While on the Saudi side, we always see that there is an expression of a declaration of readiness for normalization, but they verbally invoke the rights of the Palestinians. But in fact, the Saudis want something related to their own interests in exchange for announcing normalization. This is the rule from which we must proceed when analyzing when Saudi Arabia will announce official normalization with the Zionist enemy. The issue is related to U.S. protection. All the events that have taken place in the region, especially in the past 5 or 7 years since Mohammed bin Salman came to power in Saudi Arabia, indicate that he is ready, enthusiastic, and completely convinced of normalizing relations with the Israeli enemy. But he links the issue with what he wants from the Americans, especially in them providing him the umbrella of protection he needs, primarily against his own people. Because the main fear of these dictatorial regimes comes from the fear from their own people, before they even talk about a danger that may come to them from abroad. And here they mean the revolutionary thought sponsored by the Islamic Republic of Iran in confronting the Zionist enemy, such as supporting the resistance movements. They see this revolutionary thought as a danger. Mohammed bin Salman wants to withdraw an American reaffirmation of the guarantees in the matter of protection in order to announce the steps of normalization. This was said by many Americans who visited Riyadh in the past months and years. Every once in a while, this matter is confirmed through what these officials and journalists say and write.
Listen to what you're saying, because Saudi Arabia's current position, especially the official one, is that it will not normalize relations with the Israeli entity unless and until the Palestinians have a sovereign and independent state based on the 1949 to 1967 borders. Now, the kingdom does not even mention Gaza. They don't mention the expanding of settlements. They don't mention what's going on in Jenin right now, nor the refugees and their right of return. But if the only thing that they want is a business deal, then why call it a peace deal?
As is well known, Saudi Arabia has already started trade relations with the Zionists. The NEOM project announced by Mohammed bin Salman has significant investments for the Israeli side. Also, all the projects announced by Saudi Arabia with Egypt in 2016 and 2017 of enhancing infrastructure like so-called King Salman Bridge between Tabuk and Sinai. This is all linked to the transfer of sovereignty over Tehran and Sanafir from the Egyptian side to the Saudi side. It was simply a preparation for the investment projects taking place between Saudi Arabia and the Zionist entity. I imagine that Saudi Arabia is still embarrassed by an issue related to legality. I mean, they believe and know that the moment they announce the political normalization agreement and conduct a diplomatic exchange with the Zionists, they know that this will damage their image in the Islamic world, in the sense that they are the protectors or custodians of the two holy mosques in Mecca and Medina. This issue was highly considered by the Saudi leadership, so they are going against the natural approach in the issue of normalization. They establish all the relationships that result from the normalization process in the first place, and the step of announcing normalization would be left for the last phase. This is what Netanyahu said in his interview with Al Arabiya. He said that Arabs have always believed that the solution should be done first with the Palestinians, and then comes a normalization of the Arab countries with Israel. Now, the so-called Abraham Accords have proven otherwise. So from their perspective, it is possible to establish relations and establish trade exchange and whatnot. And then later on, the rights of the Palestinians can be discussed. Netanyahu is trying to promote the idea by showing how it happened with the UAE and Bahrain.
But
there's one other thing that Netanyahu mentioned is the common foe for both entities here, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, who Netanyahu vowed during the interview that, I quote, we'll do whatever it takes or whatever is necessary to stop Iran from having a nuclear arsenal, even without U.S. consent. But will that appeal to Mohammed bin Salman that, hey, we have a common enemy here, will that appeal to him, or rather the regional shifts might have already changed Mohammed bin Salman's priorities from this right now?
This announcement by Netanyahu is not new. He has been saying this since before 2009 when he came to power in the Zionist entity. Now he is trying to use this narrative only to capitalize on the current situation, as there is no progress in the nuclear negotiations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the P5 plus one countries. Netanyahu is trying to seize this moment in order to reassure the Saudis and others that this is a historic opportunity that must be seized. In my opinion, Saudi Arabia knows the dangers of declaring an open alliance with the Zionist entity in confronting the Islamic Republic of Iran and the regional resistance movements, although this alliance already exists under the table. For example, Saudi Arabia's classification of Hamas as a terrorist movement and all resistance movements as a terrorist movement, as well as the imprisonment of Hamas leaders in Saudi Arabia, was the best evidence and proof that Saudi Arabia is walking beside the Zionist entity in an alliance to confront the forces of liberation in the region, on top of which is the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I think Netanyahu is trying to make a showmanship, and he's good at that, by the way. He's good at taking advantage of circumstances, especially when there are certain heated events happening. Today, the situation in the Islamic Republic and Netanyahu's words about it and how he should benefit from this situation in partnership with the Saudis, in my opinion, is the biggest evidence that a large part of what concerns the relationship between the Zionist entity and Saudi Arabia has to do with the joint plans that are being implemented inside Iran.
Which brings
Iran
to the table the weight and for the response of Mohammed bin Salman. How will it be? Will it be through the foreign ministry, or will it be through him directly to this call by Netanyahu? I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, journalist at Al Akhbar Daily newspaper, political commentator and researcher, for joining us to talk about this matter. And thank you, ladies and gents. Please do follow us weekly, because we always have a new episode for you. That's why we'll see you again next week on the Media Stream. Salam.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
As a presidential candidate in 2016, Donald Trump broke decades of precedent by refusing to release his tax forms to the public. However, the Democratic-controlled House Ways and Means Committee has decided to release Donald Trump's tax returns to the public. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The Los Angeles Times has covered the story. A House panel voted along party lines on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release former President Donald Trump's tax returns, an unprecedented move that marks the culmination of a years-long legal battle to disclose his financial records. Republicans said the move underscored Democrats' ongoing obsession with Donald Trump, warning that the release would create a dangerous weapon that could be used against other politicians, business executives, labor leaders, and even private citizens. Democrats called the move long overdue. Unlike other modern presidents, Donald Trump, who announced last month that he would run for president again in 2024, has refused to release his tax returns, which would reveal details about the source and size of his wealth, potential financial conflicts, and whether he has paid taxes in recent years. Some legal experts questioned whether the House Ways and Means Committee has adequate legal justification to release the information to the public. Democrats argued in court that their interest in seeing Trump's taxes was based on the need to craft legislation and that they would not simply release confidential information to the public. But now Democrats are under pressure to act, since Republicans will take over the House of Representatives in early January. After meeting privately on Tuesday for more than 4 hours, members of the House Ways and Means Committee quickly voted to release the returns without debate or speeches. "This is not about punishment. This is not about malicious," Chairman Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts, said after the vote. Richard Neal dismissed predictions that the committee's action would open the door to partisan attempts to release the tax returns of other prominent people. He said Americans have a right to see the tax returns of anyone serving in the highest office of the country. "This is about the presidency, and it's not about the president," Richard Neal said, adding that he plans to introduce legislation that would require audits of future presidents, including the release of tax returns. It's unclear exactly when and how Donald Trump's tax returns, spanning the years 2015 to 2020, will be released to the public. Committee members said after the vote that it could take up to a week to redact from the documents personal information such as Social Security and bank account numbers. The committee also released a summary of Donald Trump's tax return information and a report on the IRS's mandatory presidential audit program. Democrats said they were unsure if the audit program has been active during recent presidencies, but argued it was more necessary with Donald Trump because all presidents since Richard Nixon had released their tax returns and endured public scrutiny from them. CBS News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Portions from 6 years of former President Donald Trump's tax returns will be made public by the democratically controlled House Ways and Means Committee, which voted 24-16 on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release the years of tax records Donald Trump has long tried to shield. The vote was along party lines. House Ways and Means Committee Chair Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts, on Tuesday night, called for legislation that would require annual audits of a president's taxes. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged the House to take the legislation up quickly, which it would have to do since Republicans are set to take control of the chamber next month. On Tuesday night, the committee released two reports, one from its members and another from the Joint Committee on Taxation. The committee said in its report that it was clear that the mandatory audit program was not a priority for the IRS, and the IRS did not audit Donald Trump in the first 2 years he was in office. The former president's individual income tax returns filed in 2018, 2019, and 2020 were not selected for examination until after he left office, and only the 2016 tax return was subjected to a mandatory examination. Richard Neal said after the vote that it would take a few days to release the returns to the public, since there will have to be some redactions to protect sensitive information, such as social security numbers, PIN numbers and bank account numbers. He said they will begin redacting on Tuesday night. Republican ranking member Representative Kevin Brady of Texas said the release will likely include 6 years of Donald Trump's tax returns along with the tax returns of 8 affiliated businesses and audit notes. Representative Kevin Brady said the IRS audits were not complete, so any characterization of the returns themselves, you have to acknowledge this is incomplete at this time, he added. Kevin Brady called the upcoming release a dangerous new political weapon that overturns decades of privacy protections for average taxpayers in the era of political targeting. The Wall Street Journal has also covered the same story and gives us more details. The House Ways and Means Committee voted on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release former President Donald Trump's tax returns. Representative Brendan Boyle, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, a committee member, said he expected the committee to post the full set of Donald Trump's tax returns, except for information such as social security numbers and bank account details. The committee's 24-16 vote, along party lines, followed a more than four-hour closed-door meeting. The committee obtained access to the tax returns late last month after the Supreme Court denied Donald Trump's request for a temporary order that would have blocked the committee from obtaining the tax returns from the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS. The court's order ended a years-long fight but left the Democrats little time to act before they lose control of the House of Representatives majority and the committee on 3rd of January 2023. The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
The civil unrest in Iran triggered in response to the death of a 22-year-old woman while she was waiting at a Tehran police station bears the hallmark of a Western-sponsored covert war covering multiple fronts, according to a Western investigative journalist. The commotion that followed has claimed the lives of many ordinary citizens and security forces, while also allowing acts of terror and sabotage across the country. International security experts have confirmed that Iran's adversaries waged a hybrid war against the country to weaken national peace and solidarity, with a plan to hinder the country's production and progress. In the process, terrorists, freelance gunmen, separatists, and rioters rampaged the streets, burned the Quran, attacked mosques, set fire to cars and ambulances, and violently removed hijab from veiled women. Ironically enough, almost all these incidents pivoted on human rights issues and slogans. In line with human rights concerns, Britain, the U.S., France, Germany, Canada, and Saudi Arabia were all facing protests in their own territories in the past few weeks, using brutal methods to suppress the people. This is why they adamantly support those in Iran who run riots, looting, and vandalism. Furthermore, international human rights entities kept silent when it came to the crackdown in Western states,
but spared no effort in showing solidarity with rioters in Iran. To take a closer look at this political warfare, please stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. A few days ago, local Iranian media reported that the 23-year-old Mohsen Shekari was hanged after being convicted of blocking the streets during the riots and assaulting a security force member with a machete in Tehran. 4 days later, another man of the same age, Majid Reza Rahnavard, was convicted of killing two security forces with machete and executed in public in the city of Mashhad. Both were found guilty by revolutionary courts of Moharebe. Under Iranian law, Moharebe is defined as creating public insecurity by threatening lives or property with a weapon, a charge that carries the death sentence in most cases, according to Islamic Republic Penal Code. Furthermore, at least 24 other prisoners are facing execution in connection with street rampage and assault during the recent commotions and lawlessness around the country.
These two theories that exist amongst jurists are known as the theory of Tazir and the theory of order. The theory of Tazir believes in the punishment for offenses at the discretion of the judge or ruler of the state. Most of the jurists, including Sheikh Mufid, Sheikh Saduq, Deylami, and the rest, and even Imam Khomeini, believe that the judge has the right to choose any punishment for the crimes that are considered Muharrabe, no matter what crime has been committed under Muharrabe law. There are four punishments, and the judge has the authority to choose amongst them. In contrast to this theory, there is a theory called order, which says that the judge is not allowed to choose the type of the punishment freely, and he must examine the type of the crime before anything.
As expected, the mainstream Western media and their Persian language affiliates, along with some human rights groups, have condemned these events and characterized it as gross miscarriages of justice. Some going as far as calling assault, vandalism, and murder of security forces as heroic acts, and the punishment inhumane. According to political experts, such statements may appear to fail reasoning, but in cognitive warfare, the most obvious facts get so twisted until they fit the intended political agenda for target audiences. In the meantime, Iranian officials dismissed the Western criticism as hypocrisy, double standards, and interference, and vowed to continue dealing with protesters as they have.
If the enemies of Iran and the West have criticisms about the type of judgments in jurisprudence and the decrees of qisas and execution, let them come and discuss to see if our claim is correct or theirs. First of all, each of the decrees and laws has its own requirements. And secondly, these kinds of dealings are solely political and the legal aspects have been ignored. My argument is also legal. But these double standard policies that we see amongst the anti-Iranian media are completely political. They see themselves in a political campaign and intend to break down and defeat their rival, which is the Iranian government and nation. Therefore, we see that every now and then, appalling executions take place in Saudi Arabia, but the media and Western governments remain silent.
From a click of a button in the U.S. to the violence on the streets of Tehran, security experts are indicating that the recent riots in Iran are being engineered and provoked from outside. A few days after the protests erupted on September 16, the Washington Post revealed that a number of bot and trolls of Pentagon psychological operations accounts operated by Central Command, that is CENTCOM division, were exposed by some American research firms. As a result, it was indicated that a significant proportion of CENTCOM's online disinformation and psychological warfare efforts were directed towards Iran.
In fact, today in England, when trained police dogs attack protesters and injure them violently, the reality is quickly swept under the rug and the news about it is silenced entirely. That is, there is no news coverage about something that is true. But if the smallest incident happens in Iran, they falsely attribute it to the Iranian police forces. like a few days ago when a woman was thrown off the elevator by her fiancé, the enemy media attributed to the recent riots and blamed the Iranian police. We see this double standard policy, but the reason is the same as I said. The West cannot tolerate independent and powerful states. If you are a friend of America, you can behead and execute more than 80 people in one day without a trial.
According to the mentioned investigative research, Pentagon bots and trolls use different narrative techniques and approaches in an attempt to influence perceptions and engender engagement. A key strategy was the creation of multiple sham media outlets publishing content in Farsi. Numerous online channels were maintained for these platforms, spanning Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and even Telegram. In some cases, fake journalists and pundits with numerous followers on those platforms emerged, along with profile photos created via artificial intelligence.
Unfortunately, in the past four decades, although according to the Constitution, one of the duties of the judiciary is to discuss the prosecution and punishment of criminals and the important issue of crime prevention, we have to admit that the judiciary has really failed in this field. Of course, the duty of crime prevention is not the responsibility of the judiciary alone, and the entire government and society must work hand in hand. But the judiciary must unite all forces to achieve this goal.
Some of the fake news organizations utilized in this campaign publish original material, but much of their output was recycled content from U.S. government-funded propaganda outfits such as Radio Farda and Voice of America Farsi. They also repurposed and shared articles from the British-based Iran International, which appears to receive funding from Saudi Arabia, as did several fake personas attached to these outlets. These personas frequently posted non-political content, including Iranian poetry and photos of Persian food, in order to increase their authenticity. They also engage with real Iranians on Twitter, often joking with them about internet memes. These clusters of social media posts may appear innocuous and authentic in an age of clickbait and viral fake news, yet when aggregated and analyzed, they form a potent and potentially dangerous weapon, which it turns out is one of many in the Pentagon's regime change arsenal.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here's how it looks on the page. Xinhua Net reads, Iran slams U.S. claims of supporting Iranian women. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani slammed the U.S. claims of supporting Iranian women, saying they have been equally impacted by Washington's long-term unilateral sanctions on Tehran. U.S. officials have repeatedly announced that the Iranian people are not the target of their sanctions, said Kanani, adding, how is it possible to impose over 1,700 or 1,800 sanctions against a country which is an unprecedented international record in relations among states and claim that women and children are not affected by them? Following its 2018 withdrawal from a 2015 nuclear deal, the United States imposed more than 800 unilateral sanctions against Iran. A move that is totally in contradiction with its fake slogans of defending women's rights, Kanani said. Tasnim says, war on Iran out of question, General. Iran's success in gaining full deterrent power has made military onslaught against the country a non-viable option for the enemies, the head of the Civil Defense Organization of Iran said. Brigadier General Ghulam Reza Jalali continued, "The Islamic Republic has become so powerful that no enemy would dare to pose a threat to the country, considering the cost of a military strike." He also highlighted Iran's advances in the drone industry, saying the enemies cannot accept Iran as a regional power in this sector, which is why they seek to harm the country in other non-military fields. The commander said the U.S. has admitted that Iran's success in extending the range of its missiles and boosting the accuracy and power of its fire has increased the costs and risks of American forces staying in the region. Irna reads, "Human rights a tool in Europe's political toolbox, Iranian envoy." Iranian ambassador to Austria Abbas Bagherpour Ardakhani has criticized European countries for using human rights as a political tool against other nations. The ambassador made the criticism in a tweet. "To the Europeans, have you ever summoned any Israeli regime's rep for their persistent brutal crimes against children and women? Or others whose government executed 81 people in a single day? Surely not, since human rights is just a tool in your political toolbox." The Iranian diplomat ended his tweet with hashtag double standards. Other reported CENTCOM psychological warfare narratives have direct relevance to the upheaval that has engulfed Iran in the last couple of months. For example, women's rights, corruption, and the cost of living narratives, which is directly the result of suffocating U.S. sanctions, are all key stated motivating factors for the protesters that were used by PSYOPs.
One of the most fundamental issues that merits a mention and the main reasons behind such biased policies of these media outlets is that their puppet masters cannot tolerate the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Iranian nation and the goals that this nation pursues. Their efforts are based on their own standards, whether in the field of human rights or in the field of media or the type of government in Iran. They seek to create this feeling of disappointment among the Iranian people. They want to make them give up supporting their government. It seems to me that today, significant amount of money is spent on social media to engineer public opinion in Iran.
Additionally, despite the rioters' widespread acts of violence and vandalism targeted at civilians and authorities alike, they also claim to be motivated by human rights concerns. And in light of America's never-ending plots against the Iranian nation, there is a new narrative put out in that regard. It is about the recent court rulings in the Islamic Republic. First, they start the warfare in which they encourage aggression, violence, and even murder, and then criticize the punishment as acts against humanity. In response, Sayed Majid Mir Ahmadi, the Deputy Interior Minister for Security and Police Affairs, has reacted to criticism against Iran for executing Shekari and others, saying the enemy's propaganda in this regard aims to prolong the unrest. He said that the people have demanded that the judiciary put the rioters on speedy trials, and the judiciary has done so. According to local media, other security officials said the enemy's propaganda against the judiciary is natural because they want the rioters to act freely.
There is no doubt about a punishment when the crime is evident. A crime that is committed in public, everyone closes their shops out of fear, there is a stabbing in the street, there is no question about such a crime. Don't you believe that such crime poses threat and creates insecurity? Hasn't the security of the society been compromised? Well, in such a case, one of the principles of Muharebeh has definitely been realized. The law that orders the execution of this person has gone through its stage. It has been approved by the Majlis or Parliament. It has been approved by the Garden Council. And there it has been approved by six jurists and six lawyers.
But what is Muharebeh? According to some Islamic scholars, the root of Muharebeh in the Islamic context literally means waging war against society. And in Islamic jurisprudence, traditionally it is referred to as acts such as killing non-combatants, assassinations, setting fires, or poisoning water reservoirs. Crimes so serious and repugnant that their perpetrators were not to be given sanctuary anywhere. Also, other Islamic scholars interpret it as acts that defy universal codes, such as intentionally killing civilians during warfare or causing random destruction.
In the area of Muharebeh and corruption on earth, we have to make a distinction between protests and riots. Protests are carried out in a peaceful way when the protest is marred by insults, destruction, assaults using a machete, It is no more considered a protest, but riots. Peaceful protests are one of the progressive principles in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Both protests and gatherings are legitimate and allowed as long as they do not contradict the Islamic principles. As a result, if this protest or gathering deviates and goes towards riots, it must be stopped. As we saw in the recent riots, for example, a young man appears from nowhere in the holy city of Mashhad and unfortunately martyred two Basiji members and injured four others. Well, this rioter was sentenced to death in public. Now, even if this sentence was not issued under the law of Muharibah, it would be issued under the law of Qisas.
The term Muharibah is widely used in Iran's Islamic judiciary and is often applied against those who take up arms against the state and usually carries the death penalty. Executions for Muharibah are rare, but in the past they were usually used against members of armed opposition, terrorist groups, and common criminals. In Iran, there are also Islamic and socio-political scholars who oppose the use of Muharibah charges and make arguments about its interpretation.
When faced with a difference of opinion between jurists, the legislator usually chooses the path based on a predetermined policy. In the Islamic Penal Code approved in 2013, our legislator voted for the type of tazir for the punishment of Muharibah crimes. That is, here, the judge should take into account what happened in the crimes and the effects of this crime in the society, as well as other issues, and choose one of these four punishments for the criminal and give a verdict. The judge can issue a death sentence, and it's not necessary for a murder to happen in this case. For example, sometimes the criminal has not perpetrated a murder, but he or she has created an intimidation or a threat in the society and amongst people which is so intense. In this case, the judge issues a death sentence.
According to the Iran Penal Code, corruption on earth offenses are punishable by death penalty. Article 286 of the IPC defines corruption on earth as a person who commits a crime on an extensive level against the physical integrity of others, the domestic or external security, spreads lies, disrupts the national economic system, undertakes arson and destruction, disseminates poisonous, microbiological, and dangerous substances, establishes corruption and prostitution centers, or assists in establishing them.
Naturally, the respected judge usually issues a punishment that has an effect stronger than the threat or intimidation created by the crime itself, meaning that a punishment that has deterrent power and creates a situation that others do not dare to repeat that crime. We should not forget that this person drew a weapon, killed two officers in cold blood, and injured four others. This rioter in Mashhad actually killed two Basiji members who were present in the street to create security on that day. And these were the ones who used to go to deprived areas of Iran to perform public benefit activities or help the flood victims in different provinces of Iran. There is no question that Islamic mercy, forgiveness, or doubts cannot be considered for this person.
Among the charges punishable by death penalty, murder and rape charges are tried by the criminal courts, while all security-related charges, corruption and drug trafficking are processed by the revolutionary courts.
Maybe many people don't know that if someone takes a machete and enters a gathering in the society and creates fear and terror in the people, he or she has committed the crime of Muharibah and may be sentenced to death as punishment. When such an incident happened in the society and the perpetrator is arrested and the death sentence is issued and he or she is executed, naturally this will remain in people's minds and will prevent many people from committing such a crime. Therefore, it cannot be denied that it will have a deterrent effect in favor of the society.
Here, Islam says that it is expedient to punish this criminal without wasting time so that the society can be saved from the state of insecurity.
Based on some recent media reports, leaders of intelligence security community in the West are pretending that they are concerned about the recent executions in Iran. Perhaps the reason is that they are afraid of losing their mercenaries in the country who seek anarchy and separatism. In their assessment, the unrest of the past 3 months is not a fleeting phenomenon.
We do not know the details of the case. Most of us have heard the news story and seen only a few minutes of a short video, and we easily say that the judge should not have issued such a sentence. There is no doubt that we are not judges and we cannot judge like this. We also need to have access to all the details to make a true and rightful judgment. Our statement is not correct as we do not know the whole story. On the other hand, we may have access to all the details but still have an opinion contrary to the judge's opinion. These are normal.
Meanwhile, a recent article published in a West Asian online media revealed that Israel's intelligence agencies have devoted most of their efforts, budgets, and energy for many decades to monitoring developments in Iran. The reports indicate that while much of the emphasis has been placed on Iran's nuclear ambitions, weekly discussions and assessments have also been devoted to the stability of the establishment and prospects of its survival. One of the assessments on this regard was voiced in 2002 by outgoing Mossad director Ephraim Halevi, who predicted that the government in Tehran was near collapse. In the ensuing 20 years, at least five Mossad directors and five prime ministers have come and gone in Israel, but Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership and government continue to sustain the reins of power.
One of the basic issues here is the issue of human rights. This concept plays like a tool at the hands of the Democrats in America and European countries. I mean, they have a tool called human rights, and they always use it against independence-seeking countries who oppose their policies. During the last four decades, the Islamic Republic has experienced this. Otherwise, what is the reason behind this deafening silence about the settlement on the houses and lands of Palestinians in the occupied areas, or the journalist who was killed by the direct fire of the Zionist regime police, or the massacre of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia? Do you think these issues are not worth a mention in their media?
So even Israeli optimists are unwilling to place bets on a regime change in Tehran at this point. The changes Iran is experiencing at the moment will not necessarily result in a revolution or a change of government. Right now, we do not see this happening in the foreseeable future, said a senior Israeli security source. The country still has many tools with which to defend itself, and it has not exhausted any of them. According to the interview in the mentioned article, three elements are still lacking for the unrest to overturn the establishment. The first is prominent charismatic leadership, as was the case with the founder of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Right now, the unrest lacks a prominent leader, and that is a distinct disadvantage.
Many times I have passed across the parliament building in Tehran and saw with my own eyes that the teachers have gathered and are protesting, or the workers and retirees. The police are also there to maintain security, and they never attack the protesters. At some point, some vandals may want to seize the opportunity to cause damage, conflict, or assault. The presence of the police prevents such incidents.
An additional element missing from the protest wave is organized funding of clear provenance.
The judge is an independent person. The judge should never be influenced by the anti-Iranian media and their propaganda. The judge should never be influenced by the government and should not be influenced by the opinion of the people. This judge can give the right verdict. According to Islamic principles, it's the judge who must be accountable to God on the day of judgment for the verdict he gives. Therefore, it's emphasized in Islamic teachings that the judge should not be influenced by anything, even his own feelings.
The third element is the backing of respected clerics. The public in Iran is not abandoning Islam. Most Iranians are religious people. A religious authority is needed to move the demonstrations up to a more powerful level and provide them with religious justification. For now, such authority is absent, said the senior intelligence source.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Do tune in again same time next week and each week after. And don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.